I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Tuesday, February 26th, 2019. And present today, we have Representative Knopp, Representative Lebon, Representative Hilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, Co-Chair Wilson, Representative Ortiz, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And as we start, just a reminder, if folks could please mute your cell phones. Today's presentation is the Legislative Finance Overview of the Governor's FY20 budget, and it will be presented by the Director of Legislative Finance, David Teal. So, Mr. Teal, if you could come to the table and put yourself on the record and proceed. And I think you prefer to allow questions during the presentation. Is that correct?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. If you could put yourself on the record.
David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division.
Thank you.
Well, the governor made it clear that the December 15th budget that he submitted to the legislature was a placeholder. And we've all waited 2 months for the amended budget, the real budget, some with eagerness, some with curiosity, and maybe some with a bit of apprehension. But now that it's here and you're organized, we can start discussing the budget and then move on to action. I can't tell you what actions to take on the budget, but I can discuss whether the budget meets expectations. Again, not your expectations, but perhaps I should say whether it meets the principles that the governor set out when he released the budget. Should probably say also that there's a fine line when we're talking about proposals. There are some people who may think that anything less than enthusiastic support is criticism, and to that extent there's some criticism in the remarks I make today, but I just want to be sure that everyone knows that the criticism is on. It's not ideological, it's not personal, it's merely a discussion of the process and some of what's in there, but mostly the way it's presented.
Would you mind pulling your mic up just a little bit closer? Thanks.
Okay. The OMB website contains a video and a statement by the governor about the budget. I would like to walk through those items. The first, that expenditures cannot exceed revenue, is something that is certainly true in the long run. And back in January, I used this graph. Some of you may have seen it. It's something we talked about in a caucus meeting. I actually have not had an overview session in front of this committee, and the overviews that you've seen are more on the fiscal situation rather than the budget, because we haven't had a budget until recently. But I use this chart, which shows real per capita revenue and real per capita expenditures by the state, and noted that the governor's policy point that expenditures equal revenue is simply a mathematical relationship with policy implications. And I don't think there's any question that the bars, the expenditures, exceed revenue, the green lines, in recent years. And even with the addition of POMV in FY19, which adds some black to the green, so it increased revenue, that we were still substantially below. And now with the reductions proposed by the governor, we're essentially at a balanced budget point. But again, going back to 19 and earlier, the issue isn't do expenditures exceed revenue. They did. no argument there. The question that matters is, do expenditures exceed revenue because expenditures are too high or because revenues are historically low? And that's for you to judge. You can see that expenditures, operating budget in real per capita terms, has been fairly steady, while revenue has sometimes been very high, and then in recent years, revenue fell with oil prices. So that the mathematical relationship is easy, the policy implications are less easy. The OMB director says, well, it's obvious which one is which, because we can see that expenditures are too high because they're greater than revenue. And of course, you can turn that around and say, well, it could be that revenue is too low. But again, that's for you to judge. In my opinion, the question can only be answered as you review the budget and decide what you want to spend, where you want to spend it, how much you want to spend, and then compare the expenditures you want with the revenue that you have. Decide what you want to do to fix the deficit, if there is one, at that point.
A question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you go back to the other slide, in 2019, when we had the POMB for the first time, if we had had the same concept and stayed living within our means, how much more would we have to have reduced the budget to have stayed there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, at the time the legislature left, we expected a deficit of about $700 million. So that's the reduction to balance the budget, but it turned out that revenue was actually higher than anticipated. And at this point, it looks like that number is closer to $300 million.
A follow-up?
Follow-up.
So if we had utilized the amount of revenue from the forecast of that year plus a POMB, we actually would have had a surplus versus still filling in a deficit.
Oops. Through the chair, that's correct. But the same is true this year. If you didn't pay dividends at all this year, there would be a deficit. Well, sorry, a surplus of about $300 million. That's just some quick math, knowing that the dividends cost about $1.9 billion, proposed dividends, and that we've got about a $1.6 billion deficit. So no dividends would mean a surplus of $300 million.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
But we gave a dividend last year. I mean, we still would have had to put more out of it, so I don't think it's a zero dividend, really. It's just about looking at the dividend, looking at how much government needs to be able to meet the requirement portion of it, and having kind of that discussion, where in the past years, really, we haven't had the discussion because we've always taken out some kind of savings account. Is that not true?
Through the chair, that's true. And I guess you could make the argument then that in FY20, if we paid the same dividends we paid last year, we would have an additional $900 million in the general fund, and that would have reduced the deficit, projected deficit, to the 1.6 minus 900 gives you a roughly $700 million deficit.
Thank you.
I'd like to also note that we've been joined by, at the start, Representative Thompson. Thanks for also being here. I've got a question from Representative Ortiz in the mirror.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Teal, each of these bars, which represents government expenditures from year to year to year, do they always include the dividend expenditure to get to those bar levels? Is that always included?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, they're not included in any of the bars in any years. So we did that because dividends in past years were sort of put at the bottom of the fiscal summary. It was, in a sense, off budget. And I think Ledge Finance, OMB, the chairman at some point said, dividends are not really a zero expense. They should be shown as a state expenditure. We are spending state money. They require an appropriation. So let's put them on there. But historically, we haven't gone back to do that. And then there's some confusion because we would have to show the revenue as well. So each of these bars would be up by the amount of dividends, and revenue would also be up by that same amount in each year, if that makes sense to you. In the same way that in FY20, we're showing, you can see here, about half the amount of revenue from POMV that we had in 19. That's because in FY19, roughly the same $3 billion payout from the earnings reserve account, but $1 billion went to dividends, leaving $2 billion to the general fund. So we have revenue of $2 billion. This year, it's closer to $2 billion going out, which leaves us with $1 billion of net revenue to the general fund. So we're now showing that extra revenue, but only the net to the general fund, not the portion that goes to dividends. And we don't show the dividends either.
Follow up?
So just to be clear then, under the 20 GOV category, if you were to include the dividend, that bar would go up another representation of $900 million?
Through the chair, it would go up by $1.9 billion, the entire amount of the dividend. And of course, then the expenditures would go up by $1.9 billion as well.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Merrick.
Thank you, through the chair. If we have an expenditure of $1.9 million for PFDs, what's the dollar amount for each recipient?
Through the chair, it's roughly $3,000.
Please proceed.
On point number two, Don Ardwin, the director of OMB, said the budget was built from the ground up. I think many people interpreted that to be zero-based budgeting. It is not zero-based budgeting. If it were zero-based budgeting, you would have had the analysis of impacts of the cuts in front of you right now. They would have been required to develop the budget. But you don't have them, and Donna Ardwin later clarified that the process was really core-based budgeting. They prioritized things, but they didn't necessarily have a position paper or any kind of vetting of their ideas. On core services, Senator Murkowski spoke to the joint session and said that core services include education, health care, and access to transportation, and noted that the governor's budget has major reductions in all three of those areas. So whatever the process is called, it seems apparent to me that many of you share my frustration with the lack of analysis, the lack of evaluation, lack of vetting of the proposals. They seem to be ideas thrown out there without the defense that you might expect. Perhaps you run into the same problem that I have. I don't see budgeting as merely a math problem. Expenditures equal revenue is an equation, but it doesn't tell you what to do. It just tells you when they're not balance, you've got a problem. I think that making good budget decisions, making good policy decisions requires good information, and I don't believe you have that in front of you yet.
We got a question from Representative Johnston.
Thank you, through the chair. I think the other part of the core-based budgeting that we received from the OMB director was the core programs. Which would be public safety, management of natural resources, and preserving maintenance of our transportation infrastructure. And will you be addressing the budget and how that, how those three things fit into the core-based budgeting?
Through the chair, I can address the budgets in those agencies, but I don't tie it back to core. Part of that is because we don't have the priorities yet. They again said that they were developed by setting these priorities, and I know that Health and Social Services may have released their priorities, at least in the Senate Finance Committee, and I'm not sure whether the House Subcommittee on Education's met yet. But I haven't seen all of those priorities yet. So I assume that you haven't seen them either. I'm also assuming that at some point they will be made available to you at subcommittee, and that will be the discussion that you'll have at subcommittee, is how, you know, how do you stack up core programs and spending?
Follow up? I guess all I'm trying to highlight is that there were the guiding principles, and they called them basically guiding principles, and then they had in the budget, they called core programs. So I just feel we should keep that in mind.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Teal, at page three again. This sheet, which is trued up for inflation, so it reflects relative values year to year. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, that's correct, Representative Josephson. It's adjusted for both population growth and for inflation.
Follow up. So in that case, it reflects that in the coming fiscal year, the administration wants to spend less than the legislature spent before first oil flowed out of taps. Is that right? I think that was August of 77. And you've got a 75, FY75 shown there.
Through the chair, I think what you're doing is just tracing this line across and saying, where are we with per capita spending? And per capita spending in FY20 would be, it's lower than FY04 and certainly lower than kind of the 80s and puts us back on a par with the late 70s. So if that's what you're saying is how does spending per capita basis, real per capita basis, compare to the past, we're as low as we've ever been.
And just to follow up, again through the chair, so what it reflects is that before production through TAPS occurred, I imagine there was some small amount of revenue from the Kenai Peninsula that we actually budgeted more in relative dollars for government based on state income tax and other smaller sources of revenue relative to population and inflation.
Through the chair, that's correct. I think we had an income tax through 81 or early 80s anyway, so that and you can see that production didn't really start till here. Some people say, well, you pick 75 or 76 for a reason, and you know, back beyond that we were ahead of that. And I can tell you that we picked 75 because that's as far as our system went back reliably electronically. If we went back further than 75, we'd be dealing with paper budgets.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
On point number three, the governor wanted to protect and maintain our reserves, but the budget pulls $436 million from the SBR, the Statutory Budget Reserve Fund, and from ADA reserves. So just to put that in perspective, in FY19, the budget is expected to pull less than $300 million from reserves. So we're pulling more from reserves in FY20 than we did last year. I got a question.
Your question, Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have an opinion about the amount pulled from ADA as to, is it too much? Is it just right? Is it sustainable for the operations of ADA, or do you have an opinion on that?
Through the chair, Representative LeBond, I think you addressed that point very well last week when you expressed your concern that as a banker, you made loans for economic development projects, often with the participation of ADA, and that even this reduction of ADA reserves will limit their ability to finance economic development projects. To me, if that's the direction you want to go, that's a policy call. What I would point out is that this is a one-time draining of reserves. You're taking over half of ADA's reserves, and you cannot continue to take this level of reserves from ADA for very long.
Thank you.
So just to summarize what you said, about $437 million is being taken from reserves. So technically that $1.6 billion in cuts that I think the public is thinking are cuts, really almost a quarter of that is coming from pulling from savings reserves, correct?
Mr. Chairman, you're sneaking ahead in the slide deck.
Okay.
We'll get to that. Point number four, the budget doesn't take additional money from Alaskans through taxes or PFDs, yet it doesn't really rely on existing state revenue to balance the budget. It pushes costs onto municipalities, removes tax revenue from municipalities, and some, if not all, of those costs will be passed on to citizens. So it's, you know, I'm not saying that they're not following the principles. I'm just saying, well, think about this. How are the principles really followed to your satisfaction? And the fifth point here is that a budget should be sustainable, predictable, and affordable. Yet you know that if expenditures were set to equal revenue every year, that our revenue bounces around. It's based on oil. It's volatile. And that the equation would then say, well, expenditures are cut when prices fall, and we'll spend more when prices are high. That's not really a very good way for government to work. Government works better with a stable funding. Hiring teachers back, for instance, is difficult once you lay them off. Same is true of other employees, but that's true of private business too. I mean, it's just government operates a little differently. And stability is something that means a lot to government services. GL might also want to ask, well, so what happens if oil falls to $50? Apparently, that means you now have to reduce the budget significantly more. And how do you do that when you... when you're trying to stay sustainable, predictable, affordable, you're going to be using reserves if you're going to straighten out and stabilize your spending. So maybe I'm just being literal, which wouldn't surprise people that know me. And I understand that everyone has their own interpretation of principles, words like this. But it seems to me that by setting out these principles, the governor's really taking two of the three traditional budget balancing tools off the table. He said that the $1.6 billion deficit would be filled without new revenue and without pulling money from reserves. And so as you noted, Mr. Chairman, I believe that many people think that the governor balanced the budget by cutting $1.6 billion from state expenditures. He did not do it that way, and I think that especially after hearing about the cuts to Medicaid, to K-12, to the university, Marine Highways, that people think that the cuts were a lot deeper than they actually were. They were nowhere near cutting $1.6 billion.
I had a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to page two, Mr. Teal. When you talk about the statement from the governor saying the budget does not take additional funds from Alaskans through taxes or the PFD, I think probably the clarification on this is not so much the municipal government side, but the state side. And, you know, the premise of this is that the governor has stated he does not want an income tax, he doesn't want a sales tax or use of the PFD to fund government operations. And I think that's something that needs to be said as opposed to just the statement of saying, well, municipal government now will have an increase in taxes. We don't know that yet. But I think, just to clarify, I think we need to stick with our state budget, not municipal.
Through the chair, noted, but I would also recall some comments made by members of this committee that perhaps the governor's budget puts too much focus on the Treasury as opposed to the state, and that, you know, if we look at the Treasury only, then we miss the economic impacts, the local government impacts, and that it's your job as a legislature to consider the full impacts, not just the impacts on the Treasury. But
I'm not disputing that, but I just wanted to kind of let people know what number four really means. What that statement is saying is that we don't want to impose an income tax, sales tax, or use of PFD, and I think that's the premise.
Okay. Slide five is a very abbreviated version of a fiscal summary. It's perhaps all you need at this point. As you know, the fiscal summary can be a whole bunch of numbers on a page, but we don't disagree with any of the numbers in OMB's fiscal summary. We have some disagreements on presentation, but from a pure do the numbers add up perspective, we have no arguments with their fiscal summary, and therefore you can pretty much eliminate all the other funds, the federal funds, and all the line items in between, and just focus on the UGF, because that's the only type of funds where you can have a deficit, and do a real simple comparison. So we can see that revenue in FY19 was slightly higher, $200 million higher than it's projected to be in 20. That's primarily because oil was $68 projected in 19, $64 in FY20. So oil revenue is down. The appropriations are down $73 million, roughly 5.8 billion here in 19. So that in 19 we had a deficit projected here of $262 million. And in 20, the governor is proposing a deficit of $428 million. Now that's before the new revenue comes in. The new revenue here is $420 million of petroleum property tax that is currently local revenue that he would turn into state revenue. And then it's another $20 million of shared taxes, which currently are shared with local governments, and the governor's proposing retaining that money. So it's this new revenue that puts you at a surplus compared to our deficit last year. Now, in the overview publication, I said that the governor would find it very difficult to cut money from agency operations, and that he might find himself having to cut where the money was, the Medicaid, the K-12 dividends, HNSS, the university, the larger agencies, or would end up shifting costs onto local governments. I don't think that was going very far out on a limb. In slide six, you can see what cuts the government is proposing to state agencies. And let me emphasize that this is agency operations excluding Medicaid and K-12. Those are the big formula programs in Department of Education and Early Development and in Health and Social Services. So here we're looking at a $2 billion expenditure, and what I was saying in the overview was that it's really difficult to cut $1.6 billion from a $2 billion portion of the budget. The
question, Representative Wilson.
So I appreciate that you took out Medicaid and K through 12, but would you not also, if you're looking at whether or not government has gotten smaller through the agency operations, why would you continue to leave the university in there? Because the university, although it is a decrement, it is a grant that we give the university. I don't see it as it being agency operations like I would DEC, Health and Social Services. So, and it kind of goes back to Mr. Sullivan Leonard a while ago to kind of the discussion of our boroughs and cities. How do we, besides going line by line, can we make the determination of exactly how much came out of agency operations themselves that the state's responsible for versus those that go to our municipalities, whether that's K through 12 or grants through Health and Social Services? And then again, like the university, to me, would not be, that cut would not really be in operations of state government.
Through the chair, I know the university likes to consider itself a fourth branch of government, but they're not. They are part of the executive branch, and they are an executive branch agency. So they're named in the Constitution, but for budgetary purposes, they're still considered an agency, and the state funding is like any other agency. They simply use it for their operations. You know, whether you call them day-to-day operations, we don't know. You don't budget the university the same way you budget other agencies.
So follow up?
So,
and understand that they are part of, I mean, and so is Medicaid, so is K through 12. They're all part of government. But I guess when we go back home and have our town hall meetings and they want to know how much reduction was actually done in areas that have more of a state issue like public safety, health and social services and other areas, DEC, those types of things in which we have a lot of regulation and has a different impact. I was just trying to, you know, because you took the other two out, you know, I was just trying to figure out, is there a better way of being able to say this much money came out of the budget, but it's for the municipalities to make up. Here's actually agency reductions of every day portions of it. I'm just, you know, trying to figure out the best way to break that up, because $1.6 billion has been taken out of the budget, but all of it's not out of necessarily what we would see as state operations, or at least our citizens don't.
Well, through the chair, there are many, many ways to break the budget into pieces to make it digestible. This is simply a way of saying these are the day-to-day operations of state government without the big formula programs. The university is not a formula program. It's simply money to operate the university in the same way we give money to natural resources for that agency to operate. And I guess it's up to you whether you consider those services to be a function of government, but I guess we do in our reporting. And you may say, well, can you treat them differently? And I'd say, well, I don't know how we would treat them differently. We're still going to report them because they are part of the budget process. And to us, they're simply another agency. And in this case, because they're non-formula, we left them in as most of these agencies are non-formula funded. It's the big formula funds are Medicaid and K-12. So those are the only two we removed.
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just in looking at the information presented here, can you give us an indication with regard to Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development and why they had the 297% increase?
Through the chair, that is power cost equalization. That used to be funded by power cost equalization funds, a designated fund. The governor plans to eliminate the power cost equalization fund, and not the program, just the designated funding of that program, and move it into being funded by unrestricted general funds. That's 33 million, somewhere in that neighborhood. So that accounts for the huge increase there. So again, the cuts here are 13%, roughly $260 million. And despite campaign statements made by the governor that he believed there was 200 million or more that could be cut from state agencies with no impact. Part of that is due to efficiencies. Part of it was due to his belief that there are a couple thousand positions that are funded but unfilled. And that of course is a myth. I think you understand that. But I believe that cutting $200 million from this portion of the budget would be a real stretch. And I will say that the governor exceeded my expectations on his ability to cut in this area, but then I did not foresee a 41% reduction in the university, $134 million, nor did I foresee cuts to the Marine Highway system essentially end the Marine Highway system as the residents of coastal communities know it. So again, cuts of $260 million, more than I expected, but far less than $1.6
billion. I got a question from Representative Merrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, can you explain the positive percentages, education, early development, judiciary, and legislature?
Through the chair, there are increases in those agencies. They get additional grants in some cases, but remember that on education, where you're expecting to see a large reduction, that K-12 funding has been removed from this. This is just the department itself. And so there is an increase. I can't tell you exactly what has been increased in there because I know some early education cuts were made. So it seems strange that there's an increase. I think natural resources increase is because the governor added money for fire suppression, which has been underfunded for years. And the governor simply stepped forward and said, tired of this, we're funding fire suppression at what we consider to be a more reasonable level, and it's several million dollars higher than in the past. The, let me see if there's another positive. You mentioned the legislature and the governor.
Judiciary
is primarily due to an effort to end the Friday afternoon shutdown. And it's part of the criminal justice initiative, for lack of a better word, where the governor wants to be tough on crime, so your public safety, law, corrections, and judiciary, you'd expect increases in all of those, but you don't see increases in all of those. In fact, we can get into a little more detail here. Corrections with a $30 million reduction. That's a combination of replacing some UGF. No, sorry. Yeah, replacing UGF with permanent fund, what we used to call permanent fund criminal funds. I think you're maybe familiar with the fact that felons do not get dividends, and those dividends are in fact spread to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund and then go to fund health care costs in the Department of Corrections. Well, bigger dividend last year means more dollars that weren't paid to criminals and that are available to corrections. So that's a reduction. And then that's a reduction of general funds, and then most of the reduction in general funds is due to a decision to move prisoners out of state. So despite the fact that the governor wants to be tough on crime, there's actually a $30 million reduction in corrections. Here in health and social services, again, this is not Medicaid. This is non-Medicaid programs. And what you have here is the Pioneers Homes, which may appear to some of you to be untouched because there was a loss of $18 million or so of UGF, real money, and that was replaced with the authority to increase rates. So what we're looking at here is only the unrestricted GF, not the potential for rate increases. We think, going back to corrections, that those numbers may be wrong. Our quick analysis says we expect a supplemental of $7 million or more. Similarly, in health and social services, we may be looking at supplementals there. We don't really know. We don't have the data to determine if what assumptions were used on number of residents getting what level of care, how much money they make. I don't know that the administration has such an analysis. But as you go to subcommittee to review these things, I cannot see how the subcommittees can make decisions on these proposals without the information about who is served, what are the chances of recovering money through rate increases, and how many people would be in homes, would be moved out of homes. We just don't have a set of assumptions telling us how they got their numbers.
Follow up? The legislature, 1%. Can you go into detail on that one, please?
Through the chair, you, of course, will see the legislature's budget. That's primarily because the Senate Finance Committee added two members and added funding for the staff for those two members. And then the House Finance Committee is the larger share of that increase because the House Finance Committee has cut itself substantially over the last several years, and left itself with 18 positions, only 12 of which, I think 11 of which, could be filled, according to the amount of money in the House Finance Committee's budget. So, at the request of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee Chair, Senator Stedman, he said, put money in there to fully fund the House Finance Committee. And as you go to subcommittees, you may decide that that money isn't necessary. But again, those are your decisions. I wouldn't be surprised if your conclusion is, since you didn't fill the positions, you don't need that money.
Got a question from Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're on this slide and we talked a little bit about corrections, the governor's proposing to close a correctional facility and transfer prisoners out of state. What's the fiscal note on that action?
Through the chair. These are questions that we really can't answer yet. I mean, my assumption on something like moving prisoners out of state was that you would have an explanation in front of you now that would say, here's the criteria that we will use to select who goes out of state. Here are the costs of the psychological and the health examinations. Here's the cost of transporting them. Here's which institutions they're in. Here's how we're going to pay to get them to a prison down south. Then you'd be looking at, well, we don't want to take of these estimated 500 prisoners that will be moved, which institutions do they come from? And if they come fairly evenly spread from all institutions, that is not a very efficient way to run a prison. You would move them around internally. What's the cost of the internal rearrangement of prisoners so that they can do what they say they're going to do, which is close two of the buildings at Wildwood? But again, we have absolutely no information about how they get their number, what their transportation costs in, what's included, what's excluded, how much it costs on a marginal rate to how much would you save by moving prisoners to Arizona or wherever they're going to move them to over what it costs to house them here. So again, I can't tell you what the fiscal note is on that. It's a budget proposal. You don't need a bill to do that. It shouldn't be handled via fiscal note. It should be in the budget, and you should have that information in front of you now so that you can say, makes sense to me, or maybe I've got some more questions. But I'd like to understand this before I vote on it.
Yeah, a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the $29 million savings may not have that incorporated into that number, may or may not?
Through the chair.
We just don't know.
Through the chair, we do not know, but our quick and somewhat dirty estimate was that they're at least $7 million understating their costs, and we would expect a supplemental request for that. But we haven't done what I would consider to be an acceptable analysis either.
Representative Wilson?
On that issue, but the reality is they can go out for an RFP and they can move prisoners out of state if they want to without our permission. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
So, you know, for them to say that we don't know, they can realize that we don't know really where they're in the process. I understand that would be nice if we knew that before we made the decrement, understanding whether or not we would have to come back and supplement it. But I just wanted to make sure that people realize that that is something that's underneath the administration, not necessarily under budgeting. But the other question I have is, as we're looking at things like transportation and university with a minus 32% and negative 41%, that's just an unrestricted general funds. That's not a cut to their entire budget.
Through the chair, correct. This is only unrestricted general funds. And in Department of Transportation, that cut is almost entirely on the marine highway system. It does not include the reduction in marine highway system funds, because those are program receipts, designated general funds.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And also doesn't count the capital budget when it comes to transportation as well.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So I'm just trying to kind of figure out, you know, overall, do you know with the university and transportation and those areas what the actual percent of decrement is to the entire budget for each one of these?
Through the chair, I do not, but those reports would be posted on our website with various types of things.
When we use just one source of income, and we actually have DGF out there, federal funds, especially with these two entities, I know they receive quite a bit of designated general funds as well. University does, but they both get federal funding too, so that we're making sure that everyone understands whether or not maybe federal funds went up, you know, or how they all are within this picture. Thank you.
Again, through the chair, taking the university as an example, it shows $134 million in cuts. If you were to look at total funds or even general funds without dividing it into unrestricted and designated general funds, the university is actually up by 1.4%. But as the president of the university, Jim Johnson, testified in the Senate Finance Committee, the $134 million cut to UGF is real money. When you add $134 million of tuition receipts, that's fantasy money. And he has no doubt in his mind that he cannot come anywhere close to replacing the loss of UGF with tuition increases.
And Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
And I agree with that, but I just wanted the bigger picture of it. And that is a really hard portion of that, because it hits here, as well as you said in Pioneer Homes, where it looks like there's not really a reduction because it's receipts. And whether or not they could collect that, I'm pretty sure they probably can't, because most people, by the time they get to that point, from my understanding, most of their income or assets that they have kind of already been turned over to the Pioneer Home for their care. So I don't know how many people could actually pay that increase as well. But the point I wanted to make sure that we understand a little bit better is that we also need to look at the overall picture of what they do have, federal monies currently the DGF has, because this looks like we cut transportation 32%, which there are a lot of other funds that come from within that. And I just, sometimes people don't really realize how many different funds come in to make that a whole picture. And I don't want to make it look worse than it necessarily is.
And through the chair, just to comment on that, for the marine highway system itself, the federal funds are not an issue. You're going to have program receipts, the ticket sales, and you're going to have the general funds. Federal funds, like highways, help with construction of both the ferries and the terminals, but they can't be used for operating. So in that case, it's not a big issue for the university, to the extent that the loss of general funds causes a loss of faculty and losing research grants and other things. There's potentially a significant loss of the federal funds that those general funds attract. What that is, I couldn't tell you.
And I think that's my point. It's just the bigger picture, that it's not as simple as one worksheet. There's a lot more moving parts that go along with it. And in transportation, they can't use it for design. They can use federal funds for that as well. So it does offset some operations, but not all of it.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, I guess this is a question for you. I don't know if your memorandum on the subcommittee has gone out to the members yet.
I think it was imminent this afternoon, if it hasn't already been gone out.
Okay. Well, then I don't feel too bad in spilling the beans if they haven't seen it. what Representative Wilson is talking about is again needing to see some facts, some information, some justification from the agencies. And in that memo, there it talks about a request that has gone out to the agencies requesting an impact statement for each of their changes. The fear is that if you go into subcommittees now and say, well, what about corrections? What, how did you get those numbers? And they say, we'll get back to you. You've just delayed another week or two in your subcommittee process. So those letters have already gone out to the agencies asking for impact statements on each of these so that, that in theory, when you go to subcommittee, you will have something in front of you that discusses the impacts of the various cuts to programs.
And with it, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but that just reminded me of my other question. So I think what we have to be careful in subcommittees is, because you brought up the public safety and the cut and corrections and how that went with that, but all fiscal notes with the crime bills that the governor has, as well as others, are not included in these percentages, yet that's really not something we do in subcommittee because they're bills that are pending. I mean, is that a correct statement?
Through the chair, that is correct. We don't even know what the fiscal notes are. We haven't seen a number of the bills. The first number we heard was 30-plus bills that the governor would be submitting that affect the budget. Then it became 25 bills because they were consolidated, not because they were eliminated. And that number is now down apparently to 16 bills. But again, we haven't seen the 16 bills. We have not seen the fiscal notes that accompany them, the analysis that should accompany them. But again, I don't know where we are on the analysis.
Got Representative Josephson and then Ortiz. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Teal, some of this you've just addressed, but my sense of President Johnson's statement on behalf of the university is that the sort of match he gets, and I think it brings in about $250 or $300 million in the research component, which is as much as 4 to 1, sometimes a little less. Without the initial grant, a lot of it would just implode and disappear. Is that sort of conclusion reasonable to you, that this sort of reduction could result in that sort of ripple effect?
Through the chair, it's reasonable, but you know, I don't trust, and I don't necessarily think that you should trust what appears to be reasonable. I want to see the analysis. I want to see the university's statements that say, this is what we will lose. This cut of general funds will cause these impacts on these programs, and that will cause an additional loss of federal money here of this amount. I don't think that's too much to ask.
Mm-hmm. Just a follow-up?
The
quick back-of-the-napkin calculation suggests that if the university line on page 6 were eliminated, the overall cut to the agency operations would be about 11%. And am I right that 11% is an addition, since the recession began in the fall of 2014, it's an addition to a number around 24% that the previous administration reduced? In other words, if we add the 11 to the 24, we're at about 35% in terms of operating budget cuts. Does that pique your memory?
Through the chair, I'm not sure whether you're referring to the university itself or to the totals, because if you were to remove the $134 million here, that essentially would cut this in half. And cutting that in half would mean then you're at a 6.5% reduction. So I don't know if you're talking just university or you're talking total, and I got a little lost.
Follow-up. I think I'm removing the university altogether, not just not just the reduction. But at any rate, the total would be in the range of something like 35%, looking at FY15 through FY20. Is that right?
Through the chair, I think that can maybe better left for subcommittee. I know that in the subcommittees, you will be given binders, and in those binders, you have a 10-year look back. You will also see some reports comparing FY15 to FY19. That will tell you what's happened in the 4 years, and then you'll have a 15 to 20 comparison so that you can look at that in two ways. What past cuts have they experienced, and what additional cut are agencies getting in FY20?
And a follow-up on a different topic, just a process question. You talked about the need for us to, and I guess it's gone out, to ask for impacts. Surely the Senate has done something like that, or did they not? I'm just thinking in terms of not reinventing the wheel, whether our fellows down the hall have made those requests.
Through the chair, I don't think you need to worry about duplicating. The cuts in the budget are the same. Both House and Senate are going through the same process. The departments are responding to what are the impacts of the same thing. They will simply give the House and the Senate exactly the same papers, the impact statements.
I guess my question is, has the Senate, to your knowledge, asked those same questions about impacts?
Through the chair, I think the Senate is in the same place you are. Drafted, but not maybe out the door yet.
Thank you.
It may have gone out.
Representative Ortiz. Okay. Mr. Teal.
Just to touch on this, I don't want to get deep into subcommittee stuff, but I think it's worth mentioning. We've talked about most of the others. We didn't really talk about the cuts to health and social services. That's the only one left. And their public assistance, adult public assistance, is down 15 million. Temporary assistance is down 2.5. 17 million for tribal assistance has been eliminated, and 20 million in senior benefits has been eliminated. So significant reductions adding up to $87 million in that agency. So you haven't actually started any of your overviews. I doubt that you'll get into the detail in full finance that the Senate has done. They've had nearly 2 weeks of 3-hour-a-day hearings on agency impacts. I know that some of you have watched those hearings, and I don't know if you're going to spend the committee time hearing those same things or whether you're going to do a quick overview here and then focus at the subcommittee level. But one way or the other, there's information out there. If you want to watch the Senate overviews, they'll give you a really good start on the subcommittee process. So I would just move on to other areas of the budget, since of the $1.6 billion in cuts, the agency operating part, the part that normally goes to your subcommittees, is only the 260 shown here. So slide 6 probably leaves you with a question that if agency operations weren't the means of balancing the budget, what was? Slide 7, I hope, answers some of those questions. It shows reductions here of $650 million. And I've just split the 1.6 into categories that make sense to me. You may say, well, couldn't this have been counted in some other area? Couldn't you slide this around? Yes, you can look at this a number of ways. Well, this number isn't the same as the here you had 259. Here it's 249. That's because now we're talking all non-formula, and before we just excluded Medicaid, so it's slightly different than the previous slide, because there are some formula programs other than K-12 and Medicaid. So in the formula, non-formula programs, you've got cuts of $249 million. In education and early development, there's a cut of $302 million. And that is just the cut to the K-12 formula, the state-funded part of that. You know that there are local contributions as well. And you haven't had the Senate overviews, but I know that in the Senate there was a statement that, well, there are local contributions too. And so if the implication of that was that the local governments can make up a portion of these cuts, that's not necessarily how it works. Some of you know education funding better than others. You've been on school boards, et cetera. But for those of you who don't know, local funding has two pieces, mandatory contributions, and that's based on tax rates. It has nothing to do with how much the state funding gives you. It's based on property values in your community, and then 2.65 has to go to the schools. 2.65 mils goes to schools. So you're not going to increase mandatory contributions. And then you say, well, there are also voluntary contributions because schools can contribute up to 23% of basic need, which is just another way of saying 23% of what the state gives them through the formula. And of course, with a 25% reduction in the formula, there's also a 25% reduction in the voluntary contribution cap. So if you're in Juneau or Anchorage, which fund to the cap, then your voluntary contributions are going to decrease by 25%. You cannot give above the cap. If you're from Mat-Su, where you don't contribute to the cap, local contributions could remain the same. So it depends on the community. And it depends on some other things, like how much state money goes to the communities. We know that, for instance, there's a proposed reduction of school debt reimbursement. And again, let's return to Mat-Su. If school debt reimbursement is reduced and Mat-Su Borough now has less money from the state, and they say, well, we are going to cut voluntary contributions to school districts. Bottom line is, we have no idea whether what local contributions will do, what local governments will do, but it would be extremely unlikely that local contributions go up. Again, mandatory contributions can't, and it's more likely than not that the voluntary contributions would decline. So there are indirect impacts, and I generally will shy away from the indirect impacts in discussing the cuts, because my recommendation is that you have ICER and or Ed King from OMB or Neil Freed from the Department of Labor in front of the committee to explain what effects the cuts might have on the economy. They're better prepared than I am to go in that direction. So here in Health and Social Services, cuts of $132 million. But that's a little tricky because it's mentioned down here. There's SBR for Medicaid. Well, $172 million. We say that's using reserves. But it's more complicated than that. This $172 million coming from the SBR, the statutory budget reserve, drains the SBR, puts it at zero, uses all the reserves. And it says it's available to Medicaid, but it's available in FY19 with a carry forward that says if you don't use it in 19, you can use it in 20. But the department also says, here's our supplemental request for 19. It's $15 million. We haven't changed that. We're pretty comfortable with the $15 million. If we get that, we're good. So this $172 million is not needed in 19. It's really an FY20 appropriation. So I would say that using reserves in 19 is just a way to make the FY20 budget look smaller than it is. This $172 million cut that appears in FY20 doesn't happen. The $33 million here is the power cost equalization, and we've talked about that. That was funded by DGF, and now will be funded straight from unrestricted GF, so it goes up. So $650 million worth of cuts. Then we turn to the cost shifts from state government. I'm sure you're familiar with the petroleum property tax. That requires legislation, but that would take money in various communities, primarily North Slope, but a few others get hit as well. And it would take that local tax and make it flow to the state instead. Then there's the $28 million in shared taxes, which, again, is new revenue to the Treasury. Then there's a school debt reimbursement, which is not new revenue. It's simply a payment that used to go to communities that will no longer go to communities. The same is true of this debt service. So this shows that $520 million of the deficit was filled by shifting costs from state government down a level of government. Then in using reserves, we have the ADA reserves, and ADA is the Alaska Industrial Development, and I don't know what the E stands for.
Export.
There we go. I knew we could get that acronym straightened out. And they're taking money from ADA reserves. I don't really care about what you call your reserves. To me, a state corporation, the cash reserves of a state corporation are reserves. It was UGF that built the capital to establish that corporation. And while we may have the right to take those reserves back, they are simply another form of reserves. I don't want to focus on the legalities of taking that money back or what impact it might have on credit ratings or on economic development in the state. I just want to focus on the transparency of the transaction. We think that if you're going to pull money from a state corporation or from any other reserve account, that it should show. And in this case, the more transparent method of doing this is to say we're pulling in not just the 180 in 2020, but the additional $84 million in FY19, and saying that $264 million is going to be put into the general fund and will be spent as general funds. That way, you can see where the money came from, and it will be counted as an expenditure. The way it's done in the budget now is that ADA receipts are not general funds, and it's going to be spent as essentially invisible revenue and an invisible expenditure. You just take it from reserves and it's gone. I don't see that as transparent. The bottom line here is that, and then I should probably say, this other $107 million is because the administration used the 12-15, what some people call the Walker budget, as a starting point. That budget was $107 million higher than FY19, and your starting point
is the FY19 budget. So that explains $100 million. The bottom line of the whole thing is that less than half of the deficit is actually filled with budget reductions. The remainder are shifts or reserves. Those were unexpected to me, given the five principles, but so you start saying, well, does consistency with principles matter? Does transparency matter? And again, my opinion to this is that you could argue that, Governor, please send us another bill, one that doesn't cross fiscal years, one that doesn't use reserves, one that doesn't shift costs to local governments, one that doesn't include cuts that the legislature finds unacceptable. But you're not going to receive a bill like that. I have zero expectation that you're going to get another amended budget. The oft-repeated phrase about from OMB on these budget proposals is, when asked about analysis, when asked about anything, is it's just a proposal. And kind of dangling out there is the less spoken part of that response, which Mike Barnhill did state outright in Senate Finance Committee, and that was, but if you don't accept the governor's proposals, you need to find alternative reductions because you're going to have to balance the budget just like I did. So that puts you in a box. If you don't like the tax changes in the governor's bill, if you don't like the using reserves, if you don't like some of these cuts, how are you going to balance the budget? And there, your list of tools is unchanged. You can use reserves, but that's not a long-run solution, and you can probably get through this session, but it's not sustainable. New revenue, income tax, sales tax, any broad-based tax, any kind of tax you care to name, I don't know what the chances of getting a revenue measure through the legislature are, or whether it would survive a governor's veto process if it were to pass the legislature. You can try to cut further in the agency expenditures, but that's proven to be just as difficult as we anticipated it would be. You can cut some statewide items. I think there's a little bit of room in retirement, not by shifting costs onto munis, but by changing some retirement issues, the amortization. Maybe some room in tax credits, but they're not enough to balance the budget, which leaves you with cutting PFDs. You know the trade-offs there. The dividends compete with other government expenditures, and that doesn't make that decision about reducing the PFD to eliminate the deficit any easier, especially since the governor, and I'm sure there are legislators with the same opinion, that a PFD of less than $3,000 is not an option. If that's the case, your options are very limited. But at the other end of that spectrum, you're going to have people know that there would be a surplus if we didn't pay dividends. And that leads those people to conclude that we don't actually have a fiscal problem at all. We have a political problem. And you know, however you define the problem, you've got some tough decisions ahead of you. And I believe that those decisions require strong supporting justification of any of these proposals. I hope you get it, and get it soon. But when I saw the budget, that was my first reaction is where is the supporting documentation, and what is the purpose of all of these proposals? Is this just a design to throw so many proposals out there, so many bills out there, that it throws the legislature into chaos, and you say, we can't possibly
analyze all of this during a regular session, you throw up your hands and say, we'll just accept the governor's budget. I don't know. You could also look at it as it's just a clever way of forcing a conversation, a public conversation that needs to occur before you can move forward. Are people going to look at the budget proposals and say that are required to pay a $3,000 dividend and plead with the governor, plead with the legislature to please reduce my dividend? I don't like the consequences of these cuts. I have no idea what either the governor's intentions were or how people feel about it. But I'm not sure at all how much people know about our fiscal situation, about our budget. Some questions I had were, do people know that dividends consume 37% of our revenue? Which, this was asked this morning, how much of our expenditures do they consume? Well, if you have a balanced budget, then expenditures equal revenues, and we're also spending 37% of our expenditures on dividends. So, but I don't know how many people realize how much of our budget is taken up by dividends. Do they know that the FY20 budget is actually only $123 million or 2% below the FY19 UGF budget? I think they believe there were much, much bigger cuts in the budget than there are. Do they understand that the reductions to agency operating budgets, which is in many cases what they see as day-to-day operations, that addresses only $650 million of the $1.6 billion deficit, and that the remainder of the deficit is filled by shifting costs to local governments or by draining reserves? Then you have statements by OMB that compare positions and say roughly 350 positions are cut out of the budget. But that doesn't count the Marine Highway positions because that shutdown doesn't occur until October. So the positions are still in the budget for part of the year. It doesn't count the 1,300 university positions that Jim Johnson believes that would occur there. And then if you look at kind of the same ratio here of dollars per position, if you cut $300 million going to schools, that's approximately 3,000 positions lost in school districts. So the total job loss here is 5,000 or more. And again, that's looking at it more from the statewide perspective. That's, these aren't all state jobs. The school district jobs, someone could argue, are not state, but I would argue that, well, they're certainly state supported. And it's the loss is due to the loss of state support. But you can take that or leave it. I don't have any answers to those questions, and I certainly don't pretend that I know what the citizens want or what the legislature wants. I just don't know what they know. And, I don't know how flexible the governor himself is going to be on, for instance, the dividend principle, $3,000 dividend. Well, he appeared to be pretty flexible on the maintaining reserves and pretty flexible on the tax issue. Is he also flexible on dividends? We know we've got at least 16 bills coming in. Do we know what the priority is on those bills? We don't even know what the bills are yet. And so I hope that, for your sake, that there's some priority on these, because even 16 bills down from 30 is a pretty big workload for the finance committees to consider and get through during a regular session. So we still have a pretty weak understanding of exactly what the governor intended to do and how he intended to get there. And I hope that our understanding and your understanding improves in the coming weeks. Last slide here is
Mr. Teal, before we move on to the next slide, Representative Johnston has a question.
Thank you, through the chair, and I realize this question might have more to do with the ARM board, but it's still part of the budget discussion, especially if you look at some of the job loss, and you'll have both the university and school districts probably facing some rather large termination studies, and then you also have the state employees as far as the numbers dropping there and how that affects our payments and how it affects actually the tail for the municipal governments at the end, where they actually take the lion's share with the extra amortization. And I haven't seen where any of this has been addressed.
Through the chair, excellent point. It's just another of those, what's the impact going to be? As you say, you know that there will be costs. Those costs are going to appear as increased rates. And to the extent that that rates go up, retirement rates, contribution rates, employer rates for, let's take municipality of Anchorage, because it loses some employees. Well, what it means is there are fewer employees to pay contributions on, yet the past service liability, the unfunded liability of the retirement systems is a dollar amount that's required to be paid every year. If you're going to spread that over 15,000 employees, you get one contribution rate. If you're going to spread it over 12,000 employees, that rate's going to be higher. And even if the rate affects, again, municipality of Anchorage, they're capped at 22%. And if the rate goes up, the state will absorb all costs for retirement for all municipalities and for all school districts. And the retirement costs will go up. The rates will go up. And the state will have to pay for all of it under current law. I don't know how much that number is. The only way to figure that out is to figure out exactly what your job losses are, send things off to the actuaries and get them to rerun their projections. But it's not an insignificant cost.
Thank you.
Representative LeBon.
Thank you, through the chair. On item number four, the remainder of the deficit is filled by shifting costs to local government. And that's an ongoing, that's an every year thing. If the property tax collected for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline going through Fairbanks is diverted to the state, that's an annual event. But the draining of the reserves, is that really one time? I mean, those reserves are pretty much tapped. You can't keep going back to ADA or the SBR every year and duplicate those reserves.
Through the chair, you cannot. As we talked about the ADA reserves, you know, I think they're taking an awful lot from ADA. There's more to be had there, but that's a policy call that will affect future development. Regarding the statutory budget reserve, there's $172 million in it. They're taking all $172 million. It's another one-time fix.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Teal, can you define what the reserves are?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, we typically regard reserves as being the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which has about $2 billion in it, and which requires a supermajority to spend, which used to have $15 million or so in it, and it has been the source of the reserves up to $3 billion a year that we've used to balance the budget. We've now reached the point where that's no longer an option. You might be able to use one more year to use the CBR to balance the budget, and then it's gone. The statutory budget reserve is much smaller, but it's $172 million, and it can be spent by a simple majority. It, again, is designed to be a shock absorber. It's what do you do when you have a budget, and that budget is based on a certain price of oil, and oil comes in a dollar lower than you expected. How do you balance? Do you come back in special session and say, well, we're going through the subcommittee process again because we have to find $100 million in cuts? It's much easier and more stable to simply say, we did the best we could at projections, and if we're low and we need money, we're going to have an automatic deficit filler that says if oil's not what we expected it to be, then you simply withdraw money from the reserve account, whether it's statutory budget reserve or the CBR, and you then the money is pulled from the account, and you don't have to come back and review the budget. The other reserves that are often not counted as reserves would be the reserves of the state corporations, which includes ADA, but also AHFC is the other big corporation. And then you've got reserves that are endowment types, like the power cost equalization endowment, a little over $1 billion. Some people would say that's not a reserve fund at all, that is a deal from long ago where urban areas of the state were provided with hydropower, subsidized gas production from Cook Inlet, and the urban areas got cheap power, and now we need something for the rural areas, and there's really no good subsidy for them, so instead we're going to simply subsidize their rates because they're going to be on diesel. There's no viable alternative. So that was an urban-rural deal. And, I guess you can make the argument that it spins off more money than it needs right now and that some of that money is available. You can also make the argument that what deal? I want the whole $1 billion. It's all spendable. Higher ed fund is the same issue. There's $330 million or so in there. And that's another endowment for scholarships and grants. And that can be taken. Beyond that, you're looking at some pretty small pools of money. The next big one would be the loan funds. The governor's also, he's proposing not just eliminating the power cost equalization endowment and the higher ed endowment, but also closing down the loan programs, transferring all their assets to the general fund, which comes out to be about $31 million or so. So if the governor's proposals go through, you're left with a few corporate reserves, no endowment reserves, no CBR, no SBR. And it pretty much means that your only reserve fund would be the CBR, which requires a supermajority.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Teal, speaking of the supermajority and the CBR, am I correct that the budget does not reverse sweep funds back into their accounts, that is, and repopulate those accounts as has been done in recent years, that instead it captures them and restores them, these other accounts, to the CBR? thus requiring us to recast a supermajority vote. Do I have that right?
Through the chair, let me back up a bit there. There may be people that don't understand the reference to the reverse sweep. It's a term we use. It applies to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The Constitution requires that as long as we have a liability to the CBR, in other words, we have taken money from it to fill deficits, that we have to pay that money back. The way we pay it back is through the sweep. And the sweep simply means on June 30th of every year, the balance of the general fund and all its subfunds are swept into the CBR. The reverse sweep refers to the, as you noted, traditional language that's in the budget saying all that money we swept in from the subaccounts of the general fund, that all goes back where it came from. Those funds include the worker safety fund, a lot of the funds created with alcohol taxes, cigarette taxes, and other things for special social programs. If you did not reverse the sweep, all the money in them would go into the CBR and stay there. So there are two issues here. Well, one is without a reverse sweep, we're just causing ourselves a nightmare of accounting problems. They probably can get through. There was 1 year since the Constitutional Budget Reserve was created in 1991, 1 year where there wasn't a reverse sweep. Agencies just had crazy accounting problems because they didn't have the cash to do what they were supposed to do and ended up booking things at different times and correcting books and so on. So it's a mess for them, and kind of an unnecessary mess in my opinion. There's the reverse sweep has been a fairly non-controversial supermajority vote in the past, I think, because everyone understands that it doesn't cost any more money. In fact, if you don't do it, it just makes it more difficult for agency accounting. But on the CBR language, what's missing is the reference to access to the CBR in case there's a deficit. Well, you might argue that we don't need that this year. There is no deficit. But if you look at this, where are we? We're at a $20 million surplus. If oil were to fall by 50 cents, you're in a deficit. If you're in a deficit, then you're back in here saying, what do we cut? So again, that's why I was saying you want some sort of automatic deficit filler, because our revenue is so volatile that we don't know whether we're going to be 50 cents high or 50 cents low, $5 high or $5 low on our revenue forecast. So it's something that I would recommend that you put in the budget, because the governor does not have any automatic deficit filler language.
Just a follow-up? Through the chair, Mr. Teal, so it sounds like you're talking about two different things. One of them is the question of the reverse sweep to the various accounts. The second one is the right for the executive branch when it's pinched and the $20 million goes away to access some number above the $20 million from the CBR by virtue of our saying, go ahead and do it. We're in our city, our hometowns. We can't be troubled at this point with this. We know there's an emergency. Just take the $100 million or whatever you need. Do I have that right?
Through the chair, you do. It's not just the $100 million. I think there's two pieces of access to the CBR as well. The language in recent years has been, any time that revenue is less than what we appropriated, then you can fill that gap by drawing from reserves. And of course, the problem with that from if you're a fiscal conservative, is where's the incentive to reduce the budget? I have none. It doesn't matter how much revenue I have. I can spend whatever I want, and the difference will be made up and from reserves, and no one really knows, right? It doesn't matter what your oil forecast was, but the public for years and years has had a deficit. How would anybody in the public know what the consequences of a deficit are when they never see it? Every deficit is filled automatically from reserves, which they don't see and don't know about. So it's a dangerous way to budget. And in recent years, you've changed the way you do that to some extent, because the second part of access to the CBR has been you can draw what you need to fill the deficit, and then we understand that you may have supplemental needs, whether it's fire or suppression or Medicaid. And that draw is limited to $100 million or whatever you set it at. So there are a number of triggers, a number of ways to do this, but for your sake, in coming back in special sessions, I think that you want to include some sort of automatic deficit filler, but that you may want to put a cap on that.
Please proceed.
This chart is just, it compares the FY19 budget to the 20 request. And as we noted earlier, the total reduction here is $123 million, or 2%. The takeaway is that even though about $1 billion of that deficit was filled by using reserves or getting new revenue, there's still $650 million in cuts. And this shows where those proposed cuts fell. What I had said in the fiscal overview was that the governor would have a real hard time finding cuts in this area, the agencies themselves, that he would have to look up here where the money is spent if he's going to achieve big cuts. That's exactly what happened. You see agencies here, 2%, 6%, 1%. Some are growing. But generally, you can't tell the difference very much between these lines. The agencies still exist, and they're not cut back very much, until you get over into the bigger bars. And there we're seeing something that I thought was a little bit strange. You expect to get bigger dollar amounts out of these bigger dollar programs, but I didn't expect to see bigger percentage cuts as well. And here you see cuts of, you know, single digit in most cases, but here 25% cut in K-12 with a 90% increase in dividends, and then Medicaid cut 38%. The 33% cut in statewide is primarily the school debt reimbursement. Health and social services, other than Medicaid, is 18% down. The university is 41% down. So much bigger hits in these bigger programs. Well, I guess you could also argue that the big money programs are your core programs. If you define core programs as those that affect the majority of Alaskans, and that's where your big service cost lies. So I think this chart is interesting to look at. I don't know exactly what you conclude. You draw your own conclusions from it. But any other questions? That essentially wraps it up for me.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. I've got a question. If you can go back to page maybe 7. So what you're pointing out here is a lot of folks are under the impression that the budget's being cut by $1.6 billion. What you're saying is not necessarily true. What we've done in this budget is shifted the cost of some state services in various ways here by $500 million. So that's not really a cut. Cost shift from state government. And then on the next line there, we haven't really cut $1.6 billion because we've used $350 million in reserves. Then we did not accept some of the increments that were proposed in the December 15, 2018 budget proposal, $107 million. So that leaves $650 million at the top there that you would interpret as being the major part of the $1.6 billion cut. But then if you go to the next page here on page 8, you've got number 2 here, which says that the FY20 budget is only $123 million lower than the FY19 budget. And I assume that's the difference there is because you're spending more for the permanent fund dividends. Is there more to that answer?
Mr. Chairman, you're right. It's permanent fund dividends. You've got an additional $1.9 billion in expenditures. So you've got cuts here. And the only tricky part of categorizing these things is that property taxes, that's not a cut. That's revenue. But school debt reimbursement is something that the state is paying and will not pay. So it's a reduced expenditure. But I categorized it down here in shifts. Someone else may want to say, no, that's a cut. It belongs up here. So some of it is up to the person putting the table together. But your difference here, you hit it when we talk about the $123 million 2%. We're not talking about the operating budget anymore. We're talking about the capital budget, the statewide items, the fund transfers, the fund capitalizations. It's the entire budget rather than just the operating budget.
Okay. So just for the public, so of the $1.6 billion in cuts, we do have indeed $650 million in agency operation cuts. But when you take in everything, the entire budget, when you include capital and statewide and everything, really the budget that's being proposed is only $123 million less than the prior year, and that's, I think, the takeaway, correct?
Yes, but you hit it when you said, well, how can that possibly be? There are cuts, there are shifts, there are other things, but how can it be that close? And the answer is because you're spending $900 million more on permanent fund dividends than you did last year.
Right. We've got a question here. I do want to recognize that we've also been joined by Representative Jackson. Thanks for being here. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to that school debt reimbursement, I would imagine that, does that, the impact on the 54 districts vary greatly, the financial impact on that varies a great deal because some districts get reimbursed because they have more bond debt than others, so they get reimbursed more. Is that correct?
Through the chair, absolutely correct. Remember that all of the REAAs have no school debt reimbursement because the state pays for their construction costs directly. So you're really talking only about the non-REAA districts. And then the school debt varies greatly. Matsu, for instance, because of its population growth, has had to build more schools than Juneau has, for instance. So we do have a sheet, I don't have it with me, that shows the impact by community of the change in school debt reimbursement.
Follow up. And with that said, is it safe to say that every dollar that a school district doesn't get in school bond debt reimbursement, they've got a
not only do they have to look for ways to compensate the 25 overall percent reduction in, well, 23% reduction in the BSA, but then they also have got to overcome within their budgets the lack of reimbursement for school bond debt. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, but there's a step in there that I need to clarify. It's not the schools or the school districts that owe this debt. It's the municipalities that issue the debt to build the schools. And when we, if we do not reimburse the school's debt service costs, then the district has less money available and may or may not reduce school funding because of that reduction.
Thank you.
Have any further questions? See no further questions. Anything else there, Mr. Teal?
No, sir.
We very much appreciate your analysis of the governor's proposed FY20 budget. And at our next meeting, it's scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 27th at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we will be hearing the fall 2018 production forecast, permitting issues, and the status of development on the North Slope by the Department of Natural Resources. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:26 p.m.